The following episode contains violent themes and occasional strong language. Listener discretion is advised. The date is April 13th, 1942. A group of Australian airmen under the command of my grandfather, Flight Lieutenant Brian Rofe, have been trapped behind lines for over 7 weeks. Three men have died, two from malaria and undernourishment, the other was bitten by a snake. After 4 weeks encamped at the village of Kapsali in remote northwest Timor, the airmen have relocated to a village called Tuakau. The village is situated on a beach they believe is firm enough to support the landing of an aircraft to rescue them. With a Japanese patrol closing in on their position, Brian has led his men into the jungle to hide from the patrol. Unbeknownst to Brian and his men, an American submarine, the USS Sea Raven, has attempted to locate the party. After failing to make contact with the Australians, Sea Raven has aborted the mission. I'm Tom Trumbull, and this is Trapped.
Men and women of Australia.
Australia! You are the sons and daughters!
The story of one of the greatest escapes of the Pacific War.
Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack. State of war exists between Australia and Japan.
To work in the defence of Australia.
Chapter 5. The Light Out to Sea. Somewhere in the hills above Tuakau, the party's senior electrical wireless mechanic, Corporal Ron Bell, is convinced there's been a mix-up with the requested listening times. Before they left Tuakau, Ron signalled Darwin about the enemy patrol and that the rear party would go radio silent. Direction-finding technology could only detect transmissions, which means they could still receive messages without risk of being located. So Ron advised Darwin the two times he would be listening for signals each day. Coincidentally, Darwin sent a message at the exact same moment, suggesting two different listening times. The situation was never clarified.
I understand what you're saying, but there's no way I'm going to put you on two listening watches.
Ron voices his concern to Brian, suggesting they turn on the receiver at the listening times Darwin originally suggested. Brian disagrees. Listening four times a day will run down the batteries. Brian assumes Darwin will give precedence to the listening times he suggested because they are in peril. It's a staggering assumption, but then Brian is not thinking clearly. His mind is on Corporal Roy Andrews.
All right, Andrews. On your bloody feet. You aren't fooling anyone. Get up.
Roy has undergone as big a physical transformation as anyone. His thick neck, round shoulders and broad chest is whittled away to skin and bones. The sharp-tongued jokester who nonchalantly smoked cigarettes through a bombing raid is gone. Nearly 2 months in the jungle has melted away Roy's soul. In Brian's view, Roy's problems are all in his head. Physically, he's no more sick or weak than the rest of them. He needs to toughen up. Brian lowers himself to within inches of Roy's face.
Come on, Andrews. You've got your parents, your brothers and sisters, all your friends at home. Don't throw in the towel. Fight. Fight hard. Keep trying like the rest of us.
Roy doesn't move. Brian strikes him across the face with an open hand. He grabs his shirt and starts shaking him, ordering him not to give up. Roy keeps his eyes shut the whole time, never uttering so much as a groan.
You're gutless.
The tirade draws everyone's attention, including leading aircraftman Len Burke.
He's the one that Brian Rafe shot, trying to get some fight into him. You know, he meant well. It didn't look good when he did it, but he meant well, certainly.
And it doesn't work. Hours later, Roy Andrews dies. Outwardly, Roy's death infuriates Brian.
Andrews was perhaps the most amazing case. He lay down and quitted. He had nothing at all the matter with him.
Inwardly, it's a different story. Brian creeps into the jungle. He lowers himself down behind a tree, buries his face in his hands, and weeps. Roy's death leads to the most profound moment of desolation for the young leader.
Living with men, watching them die in the name of a cause which they don't fully understand, knowing a fear so intense that left one physically impossible to move or reason, only to feel violently like vomiting.
As Brian weeps, a new sound emerges. The sound of numerous aircraft over Koh Phang Bay. The Japanese are preparing to be raided. The island of Timor appears on the horizon as a dark blue smudge through Flight Lieutenant Harold Cookie Cook's cockpit window. To his right, Flying Officer Roger Blanchard pilots another Hudson, the two closing in on Koh Phang Bay. Down on Timor, Cookie knows his good mate Brian Rofe is still stranded. Before the war, Cookie would take Brian up in his Hudson, one time letting him take the wheel mid-flight. Like everyone stationed at RAF Station Darwin, Cookie has been closely following the plight of Brian and his men. Cookie even volunteered to land his Hudson on the beach near the village of Tuakau. The request was denied. Cookie is on a different mission. Reconnaissance has reported a build-up of ships in the bay, and despite the risks in launching a daytime raid, this is a golden chance to hit the enemy hard. 50 kilometres from the target, Cookie drops down to 8,000 feet and starts scanning the horizon. No sign of fighters. The air is clear of flak. Once they reach the southwestern edge of Koh Phang, a ship comes into view. She's a monster.
A Didelo power glide approaching from the protection of a cloud bank towards an 8 to 10,000 ton vessel. It was anchored.
From his position behind a cloud, Cookie eases back on the throttle. The world whites out. Vapour and moisture streak the windows. He opens the bomb bay doors. In a final stomach-lifting lurch, they clear the cloud. Cookie's hands grip the wheel. Three Zeros are circling over the bay. The moment the Zero pilots see Cookie's Hudson, they loop around behind him and prepare to attack.
I realised I didn't have enough time to get to cloud cover before the enemy reached me, so I decided to do my approach run over the target.
Two fighters close in fast on his starboard wing. Cookie's got Sergeant Bert Hurl up top in the dorsal turret, Pilot Officer Vivian Leithhead manning the guns fixed to the nose of the Hudson, and gutsiest of all, Sergeant Doug Witham on the wind-down ventral gun, lying stomach-first on a ramp that extends underneath the underbelly of the Hudson. A leather belt is all that keeps Witham from plummeting to his death. All three men send a continuous stream of lead at zero zipping around the Hudson. Cookie brings the Hudson down to 800 feet. The air sings with machine gun bullets. He checks his approach and then hits the release button, laying down four 250-pound bombs. Two orbs of fire turn to black smoke on the deck of the anchored ship. Cookie scores a direct hit. There's no time to celebrate.
I went down almost to water level and tried avoid tactics. The three Zeros followed, and we soon began to be badly shot up despite very heavy fire from my two gunners and my second pilot.
Pain explodes down Cookie's right arm. A cannon shell has burst inside the cockpit. Cookie looks up and sees Blanchard in the other Hudson about 3,000 feet away, locked in a scrap with a Zero. There would be no help from his wingman. It's the last time Cookie will ever see his friend. From up front, Leithhead has just sent a burst of bullets into a fighter. The air gunners had both seen the Zero fall to the sea in flames, but the celebrations are short-lived. A Zero punches holes in the Hudson. Bullets rip up the instrument panel. An instant later, a cannon shell is sent into the turret, blowing Hurl's hand off. Down below on the ventral gun, shrapnel from the explosion enters Witham's cheek and lodges beneath the muscles of his chin, knocking him unconscious. The plane goes into a crawling yaw as the sputtering propeller clutches at the air. Smoke starts gushing from the starboard engine. Cookie turns the Hudson towards the northern beach of Koh Phang Bay. A fighter sends a burst into the port engine, setting it on fire.
We were then between 50 and 100 feet above the water. There was nothing else to do but pull both throttles back and flop onto the water.
Cookie shouts down to Leithhead to get out of the nose and prepare the men for crash landing. Leithhead races back. With one hand, he unclips the belt, keeping the unconscious Witham from falling to his death. And with the other, he pulls the gunner back to safety. As he winds up the ventral gun ramp, the Hudson starts porpoising. They are on the northern side of the bay, less than 100 yards from the shore. It's a good spot to ditch. Japanese shipping is mainly confined to an area adjacent to Koh Phang on the southern side of the bay. If they survive the crash, they'll at least have some time to make it to the beach before patrol boats start turning up. Cookie prepares his plane for crash landing. They've landed in about 3 feet of water. Seawater has extinguished the flames from the port engine. The Zeros approach, preparing to strafe. Inside a room in the reconstructed timber buildings of the Penfoe Aerodrome, Lieutenant Yamabe Masao sits at a desk, sharpening the blade of his sword. Before him sits a bottle of sake and two glasses. Earlier in the day, Yamabe had sent word among personnel working on the aerodrome.
An excursion of spies will be carried out at the setting of the sun to help console the souls of the war dead.
Yamabe invites survivors of the 9th Special Construction Unit, whose transport was bombed by the enemy aircraft. Over 100 soldiers of the unit were killed in the attack. Since the first raids over Kopang Bay, suspicion runs deep that enemy aircraft are acting on intelligence supplied from somewhere in Dutch Timor. It's too much of a coincidence that every raid takes place in perfect weather, at times when large Japanese ships are anchored in the bay. 7 Dutch civilians were arrested at random overnight and accused of radioing intelligence to the enemy. There's no radio equipment to tie the 7 Dutch prisoners to such activity, but Yamabe doesn't care, because this execution isn't about justice. It's about boosting morale. A Japanese officer enters the room. This is Chief Surgeon Ogirima of the Japanese Navy. Yamabe tells him to sit and offers him sake.
Sware.
As they drink, the two men discuss the planned execution of the Dutch civilians. Yamabe says he has something special in mind to boost the spirits of the surviving soldiers of the construction unit whose comrades were killed in the attack. Yamabe asks the surgeon the best way to paralyze a man with his sword because he wants the surgeon to perform a live autopsy. As the surgeon explains how to sever a man's spinal column without immediately killing him, a part of Yamabe's mind turns to the hunt for the real enemy spies still in hiding. The Timorese loyal to the Japanese occupiers had reported that enemy soldiers are hiding in the jungles near the north coast. A patrol sent to the region failed to find any sign of them, but Yamabe is convinced they are still there, still signalling intelligence and still calling in the air raids. Yamabe resolves that after the execution, he will order his soldiers back into the region to track down the spies. But this time, there won't be just one patrol. There will be 3, and they will each comprise 100 soldiers. At dawn on April the 16th, 3 days after Roy Andrews dies, the chief of Tuakau returns with good news. The chief had told the Japanese the Australians went in a different direction. The enemy patrol has gone. Brian thanks the chief and leads the party back to the beach. Despite the enemy patrol having cleared off, Brian is reluctant to send a signal to Darwin. On a hunch, Ron listens in at the time Darwin had originally suggested. The receiver lights up at once. Ron jots the signal down and hands it to Brian.
Have long signal, which must be acknowledged by you. Shall transmit it
when contact established with you. It is urgent that you establish contact with us.
Ron sends receipt of the signal and then moments later notes down the response.
US submarine will be close inshore 1.4 miles south of Point Kourou's for 5 nights, commencing April 13th at 1300. When sea conditions permit, will attempt rescue. The submarine will use a blinker tube to transmit SR at 2-minute intervals as a recognition signal. Your proper answer will be a flashlight or fire exhibited for periods of 30 seconds. Acknowledge.
Sea Raven will be sitting off the coast for 2 more nights. All they have to do is light a fire at the appointed hour and they are saved. It all seems so simple. Later that day, the chief of Tuakau hands Brian a letter.
To the Australian and Dutch officers and soldiers, the war is over. The Dutch East Indies fell in our hand in succession. All Allied forces surrendered to us without any conditions. They are enjoying life and are waiting for you, being supplied with bread, meat, and fresh vegetables. Your movement and present location are reported to us through Rajas. If you continue fighting against us, there is not way but to conquer you. So come to us with this information and await for the return of peace with your friends, Japanese Army.
In addition to handing over the letter demanding their surrender, the chief tells Brian that a patrol has been dispatched for Tuakau. They will arrive in 3 days, maybe sooner. Brian and his men can only hope that the Sea Raven is ready to pick them up tonight. That's when they hear it. The fittest men sit bolt upright, looking to each other for an explanation. Brian takes a head count, 31 men all accounted for. That shout, an Australian bush call used to pinpoint a person's location, is not coming from any of Brian's men. Someone else is trying to entice them out of hiding. Brian retrieves his sidearm while the crack shots pull out their rifles. Brian is the first to see movement, two shapes crashing through the shrubs. He extends his arm and looks down the flute cylinder of his revolver, catching sight of two pilot's caps.
Hold fire! Hold fire! Cookie? What? What in the hell are you doing here?
Revolver pointed at the ground, adrenaline seeping out of his pores. Brian thinks he is hallucinating.
Morning, Rofi. Bib and I were in the neighbourhood.
Brian hadn't seen Cookie since being posted to Darwin 7 months ago, and now here he is, stepping out of the jungle like an image in a fever dream. The two men shake hands. Cookie fills him in on the bombing run and the dogfight over Koh Phang Bay and tells him what happened after the forced landing on the water.
We crash alighted about 1 mile west of the village of Pariti, in about 3 feet of water at practically low tide. The Zeros circled round us a couple of times, but didn't molest us again. I believe they thought we were dead.
Timaree's villagers launched wooden craft into the water and rescued Cookie and his three crewmen. But Cookie's air gunners, Sergeants Witham and Hurl, were in bad shape.
It was obvious that the two sergeants could not be moved, so I arranged with the natives to care for them until the Japanese came, as medical treatment was their urgent requirement.
It wasn't unreasonable for Cookie to assume that the Japanese would provide medical care to the air gunners. Japanese brutality towards Allied prisoners of war wasn't confirmed until later. From Brian's perspective, Cookie showing up is a good omen. Cookie and Leithhead are in excellent condition compared to Brian's men and could be useful during their escape.
The arrival of Cookie on the Friday at lunchtime came as a tremendous surprise, and at last I could see that ace of trumps being played and everything fitting into a perfect plan.
At night, over the hill at Koh Phang Bay, RAF Hudsons are raining bombs down on the enemy. Tracers light up the sky while the deep boom of bombs and ak-ak sings out across the sea. On the beach, the airmen have built a large wall of stone out of rocks to shield the bonfire from the view of the jungle. A bonfire on the beach will draw attention. At 9 o'clock, the group gathers about the fire, squinting beyond the whitecaps. Sea Raven surfaces about 2 kilometres off the coast of Tuakau, into the cacophony of the bombing raid on Koh Phang. Lieutenant Commander Hiram Cassidy estimates 25 anti-aircraft guns firing almost continuously. At the rendezvous point, Cassidy observes 7 horsemen plus 3 pack horses and 4 men afoot. He's too far away to confirm beyond doubt that these are the Australian airmen. He also sees something troubling.
Observed blinking lights on Cape Kourous.
Those lights belong to the Japanese patrol, about 10 kilometres north of the stranded airmen. Cassidy passes word for the wherry crew to assemble topside. Once again, Ensign George Cook and Petty Officers Joseph McGreevy and Leonard Markison will crew the wherry. As McGreevy points out, they are all relieved to be called up onto the deck to get things underway.
Submerged, we went through our routine duties through the rest of the day. Tension was something we could almost touch. Surfacing that night, we were informed that the rescue was still in order.
It takes an hour to pull the wherry from the submarine superstructure. Cassidy has men on the deck gun and machine gunners standing by. 40 minutes before the appointed hour, someone spots something. a dark shape moving up behind them. Cassidy turns around, his back now to the island. Moonlight catches the phosphorescent wake of a Japanese vessel bearing northward on Sea Raven's beam.
Sighted unidentified ship 3 miles west of Kourous, point on northerly course. Speed 10 knots.
Cassidy thinks fast.
Deck gun, stay ready. Forward and aft torpedo, battle stations. Make ready the tubes forward and tubes aft. Range. Give me a range, damn it.
10 men are topside and a wherry is sitting unsecured on deck. Diving is not an option. From up top, he relays coordinates to the chief of the boat in the control room, pointing the bow of the submarine directly at the enemy vessel.
Maneuvering left, full rudder. Ahead 1/3. All stop. Stand by, torpedo. If he swings about, give him the full salvo.
Attacking the ship is an absolute last resort. The moment the torpedoes are in the water, the rescue attempt is off. Every Japanese boat patrolling the Savu Sea would be on the hunt in minutes. But the enemy ship holds her northerly course.
Stand down, torpedo. Deck gun.
Eventually disappearing behind Cape Kourous. Cassidy turns Sea Raven around so she sits parallel to the shore. The hour is upon them. Cassidy trains his binoculars shoreward. Brian gives the word to his men to flash torchlight seawards. There's no breeze, only the sound of the surf, but nobody listens to the surf. They are listening to the clock in their heads, counting down from 30. When the count is over, Brian orders the torches switched off, and that's when they see it. Here's Len Burke recalling that moment.
We flash this light out to sea. Up comes signal, SR, which I was the only one who could read it because I'd been trained in visual Morse in the Army, not in the Air Force. And goes hope. So the signalman on the sub let go of the whole lot of visual Morse code. Fortunately, that I had the training, I was able to read it. And I spelt a few words out. Manoeuvring. Manoeuvring, contact later, and a few other words.
Brian orders Ron to signal Darwin, confirming that contact has been made with the American submarine. Halfway through his signal, Ron finds himself on a dead key. The batteries are flat. Ron finds a large stick and destroys the radio before burying it.
Lower away, Joe. Hey, Johnny, keep us out of those waves.
Ensign George Cook steers the wherry towards the light on the shore and anchors about 200 metres off the beach. He sweeps his torch around the boat, searching for dorsal fins. There's no sign of sharks lurking beneath the boat. With the long line fastened to his wrist, Cook dives into the sea. Cook slides off the back of 2 large waves before body surfing all the way up to the sand. The current pushes him some distance south of the airmen. The Australians have their torches trained towards the wherry. Cook shines his light straight at them. The Australian torches turn towards him. Cook shields his eyes and makes his way up the beach. When the airmen all come into view, Cook realises the enormity of the task ahead.
Those men had hideous jungle sores on their legs and arms, and only one was free from malaria. Some were so weak they had difficulty in standing.
Brian approaches with his hand extended. Others stand, looking at the healthy American with a mixture of awe, reverence and gratitude. They file past, reaching out, grabbing Cook's hand or shoulder. Brian's Team Marie's guide, George, rushes up to Brian while the leader talks with Ensign Cook. George tells Brian that a Japanese patrol has landed at the other end of Kopang Bay and have walked over the cape towards the airmen's location. The Japanese are converging on the airmen from points to the south and east. At last report, the southern patrol are 15 kilometres away from the airmen.
Here's the deal. We got enough space to hold 18 men, and that includes the three of us. By the time your men...
Cook tells Brian the wherry is only big enough to take half the group. The hour is late. The chances of making 2 boat trips before sunrise are slim. With the Japanese certain to arrive the next day, remaining on Timor for one more night means certain death. In a circumstance where the chances of success are not guaranteed, then the cold, calculating ways of the military demand that those with the greatest chance of survival are given precedence. Brian starts calling out the names of men he figures are strong enough to swim through the waves on their own steam.
First boatload is as follows. Colin, Ken...
Those lucky few who are named breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah, okay, Jock. Jim...
All except Flying Officer Arthur Cole. Arthur strongly objects to being selected, insisting he remain until the end. But Brian overrules him.
Arthur, you're going too.
Malaria-free and relatively strong, Arthur could make the swim. Besides, Brian wants his most senior officer to tell the story if he doesn't make it back. There's one spot left on the wherry. Outside the circle, Len Burke looks down at his feet.
Yeah, he crowded around Brian just in shorts and a shirt. Went down, he came there, they could take one more. No, he won't say me, because I've known his bad books. And then he says,
How far can you swim, young Burke?
That's what he called me. Young Burke.
Can you handle 300 yards through those waves?
I says, yes, sir, I can. So I was the last one picked on the first night. The rest were thought were doomed.
Len races towards the sea, following the others as they wade in. Before he jumps in, he turns around and takes one last look at those remaining behind. Nobody responds to his encouraging wave, so he grabs his nose and plunges into the sea. The moment that the first boatload of Australians are helped onto the deck of the Sea Raven, a few hours before sunrise, Cassidy sends a signal on the blinker gun to those left on the beach. There won't be enough time to get the rest of the airmen off Timor tonight. Sea Raven will return the following night to pick them up. Brian picks up his torch and flashes a quick signal in reply. Okay, Yank. He looks to his left. He sees the twinkling lights of the patrol in the distance. They'll reach to a cowl by noon, probably sooner. Brian orders his men off the beach and then goes looking for George, his Timorese guide, to explore options. But George is gone. Brian doesn't begrudge George for leaving them. He has a family to consider. But in leaving the airmen, George is effectively telling Brian that there is nowhere left to hide. The game of cat and mouse is over. The end is near. Next time on Trapped.
Lead kindly, light amidst the surface.
Surfaced an observed air raid on Koh Phang. This one seemed to be about twice the size of last night's raid.
Rofi! What the bloody hell are you doing? Come on, let's go! They're coming!
Watch that anchor! It's slipping! Going in!
Rofi, get out of here! Quick, turn it over!
Come on, give it everything! Ooh. We're nearly there!
Keep paddling! Keep bloody paddling!
He wouldn't leave us. He stayed behind. He didn't have to, but he did. He got everyone on board before he was a good leader. Oh, no doubt about that.
One step enough for me.
Trapped was written and produced by Tom Trumbull with Sam Loy, James Milsom, and Ryan Pemberton for the Australian War Memorial.